This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hello, everyone. This is Basma Farhad of the People Speak radio show. Here we believe when the people speak, they make a difference. You can listen to the People Speak radio on BBS radio every Tuesday and Wednesday night at 8 to 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, or by going to our site at the www.thepeoplespeakradio.net. There you can also listen to past shows on our archive-ready iPod section. And now you can also listen live via satellite on your Nokia phones. Just go to the website for details. Tonight our guests are some very honored people in our lives, in the lives of America and the country. Ron Kovic was born on the 4th of July in 1946 in Ladysmith, Wisconsin, and grew up in Massapequa, New York. His autobiography, Born on the 4th of July, was adapted as an Academy Award-winning film directed by Oliver Stone, and starring Tom Cruise as Kovic. The Academy Award-winning actress Jane Fonda has stated that Ron Kovic's story was the inspiration for her film Coming Home. Ron Kovic was a U.S. Marine who served two tours of duty in Vietnam War, where he was awarded the Bronze Star and the Purple Heart. In combat on January 20, 1968, he suffered a spinal cord injury, which left him paralyzed from the chest down. He has become one of our best-known peace activists among the veterans of the Vietnam War. Our other guest tonight is Frank Kevistani, who was raised in New York City. He made his theatrical debut as Shelley Winter's co-star in James Bridges' Days of the Dancing. Broadway audience saw him in June Havoc's Marathon 33. Off-Broadway, he was in Gregory Razakis's Oris Tez and Murray Medic's Are You Looking? Frank moved into motion pictures and television as a star and co-star, co-starring on the CBS Defenders with E.G. Marshall, where he was still in his teens, and in Andy Warhol's wild epic Women in Revolt. These gentlemen are just icons in the industry. I want to thank you both for being here. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Yeah, thank you very much. And I also made that documentary about Ron. That's how we met each other, Operation Last Patrol.
Last
when
Patrol.
He did the real-life scenes from what became his famous film, Born on the 4th of July.
Well, the documentary was about the exploits of Ron Kovic, and it won awards at the Popoli Film Festival in Italy, the Lipitz Film Festival in Germany, and it's now part of the permanent collection of the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Just an incredible, incredible film. That was the 4th of July in Operation Last Patrol. Ron, there are many stories like yours during the Vietnam War. Why do you think yours resonated at the time? What was it that your story, and why was it that your story was heard above all others?
I'm not really sure. All I know is that I felt a need to tell my story. I went to a Sears and Roebuck in Santa Monica, California in the fall of 1974, and I bought a $42 manual typewriter and 500 blank sheets of paper, and I was living in an apartment in Santa Monica. I had no telephone. I had a mattress on the floor. And in 1 month, 3 weeks, and 2 days, with two fingers, I wrote Born on the 4th of July. I had a friend encourage me to fly to New York, and I went to New York City. I think it was during that time, Frank, that I stayed, or I came by the Chelsea Hotel, I'm not sure, but we were trying to sell the
book. Yes, it was. I remember well. You had coffee-stained papers written on all sides, the back and forward.
Right. I actually wrote the book. I wrote Born on the 4th of July. Single space with that $42 typewriter. I mean, it really doesn't matter if you have an expensive computer or even a pencil. If you write the truth, that's what really matters. You know, I didn't think I'd live to be 30 years old. I was 28 years old when I wrote Born on the 4th of July. And I remember during that period of time I was having anxiety attacks, severe heart palpitations, nightmares at night, and I had a feeling that I was obsessed with the fact that I wasn't going to make it to my 30th birthday, which would be on the 4th, which ironically was the 200th anniversary, the bicentennial of our country was my 30th birthday. I didn't think I was going to make it to be 30. And when I was writing the book, when I was writing Born on the 4th of July, I felt as if I was writing my last will and testament. And I remember thinking every night I would write from about 10 o'clock at night until dawn. I'd write all night long until dawn. I'd get a couple of cups of coffee and try to write for another hour or two. Then I'd go to sleep on the mattress. And I remember thinking to myself, well, if I die in my sleep, if I don't wake up, at least someone will come into this apartment and they'll find those pages, that manuscript on the dining room table, and they'll know at least that I wasn't a victim, that I was trying to rise above what had happened to me and tell the truth about what really happened in that war.
You know,
Frank, how did you and Ron meet?
Well, you know, Captain Leroy, the famous cinematographer that was in Vietnam and jumped out of airplanes with the 179th Airborne, came to me and she said, you must make this film about the veterans going to the convention in the Miami. So I said, well, if I must, I must. And I wanted to do something myself to stop the war because I'd been there for a year and 11 days to fighting as a soldier too. So I wanted first, I felt very strongly about doing something and using my art to stop this war in Vietnam. And one of the things I wanted to say is that one of the reasons I think they identified with Ron, besides the fact that he's such a poetic human being, just naturally, is that so many people were able to identify. The people here were living through it, well, with the soldiers in a way. So when they came back, so many of them felt the same way we did. So they were really behind stories like Ron Kovic's. And it's different now because there seems to be this detachment with what's happening over there in Iraq.
Ron,
it's hard to explain that, but what I can say is I went to New York with a friend, and we went to different publishing houses in the most unconventional manner you could ever imagine, like two pirates going into New York, and we had no agent, nothing. We stayed at the Chelsea Hotel, grabbed a hold of the Yellow Pages, and started calling the publishers up and asking if they would meet with us. And some of them, we were fortunate enough, some of them would. You know, I was thinking, I was in Berkeley before we took that trip to New York to try to sell the book, and we were in Berkeley, and a friend, Tony Russo, who was a colleague of Daniel Ellsberg, gave us the name and the number of a woman in New York, an editor named Joyce Johnson. And it was that phone call that changed my life. We called Joyce among several other publishing houses. Most of them turned us down. And we only had enough money to stay at the Chelsea for a week. Joyce agreed to meet with us. She was at McGraw-Hill at the time. We went up there, and she liked the book immediately. The book ended up being reviewed on the front page of the Sunday New York Times Book Review, and it was only a couple of, I would say about a week later, several days later, I received a call from Martin Bregman, who was working with Al Pacino at the time, asking me if I'd be interested in optioning out the book to be made into a movie. And before I knew it, I was in a taxi cab riding to New York City to meet with the producer, Martin Bregman, and Al Pacino, and that was at least the beginning of the first attempt to make the movie. And as all of you probably know, Oliver Stone, who was unknown when I met him, had just come back from London from writing Midnight Express, and just happened to run into a friend who suggested that he call Bregman because he was looking for a screenwriter, ended up working with me for a while until that particular project fell through. and we had to wait for almost 10 years before Oliver became famous, was in the position, had the success of both Salvador and Platoon, and was able to make Born on the 4th of July. But one thing I want to say, Oliver made a promise to me when we were in New York. This was before anyone knew who Oliver Stone was. Being a director was just a dream of his back then. And he and I had both, you know, Oliver was in the war. He had received the Bronze Star and Purple Heart. He had been wounded in Vietnam. And he wrote a script called Platoon, which at the time when I met him, nobody was interested in. I remember the day he came into the office and he handed me his script, Platoon. So both of us had two stories, and we were both struggling to get our stories about what had happened in that war, the truth, that we felt the truth of what had happened, what that war was really all about. So we were both struggling at that time. Oliver made a promise to me when the film fell through, and he said, if I ever break through, Ronnie, if I ever make it in Hollywood, I'll come back to you, and I'll make Born on the 4th of July. Well, this was a promise that he repeated throughout the years, and he did keep his promise in the end.
Very honorable man. You know, there you did mention, Frank, how some of the differences that... let me ask you, gentlemen, you know, being activists, and even with your movie-making, Frank, you are truly an activist, enhancing and perpetuating truth in media and allowing people to see the less, as Phil Donahue had said, the less sanitized versions of the war. What do you think is different about the activists today, both of you, and the activists of the Vietnam era? What are the differences? I know as an activist myself, I see quite a number of differences, but not in the passion of the people, but in the way our government handles them. What do you think, Frank? And then,
yeah,
Ron, maybe
well,
you can pick
you know,
that up.
When I re-released this film 2 years ago, I did it as a benefit for the Iraq Veterans Against the War. And I was sitting with Tim Goodrich and having a meeting about it. So I said, well, how many members do you have in Southern California? And he said, 10. And I said, 10,000? He said, no, 10. We have 10. That's all we have. I said, why is that? And he said, well, soldiers that go to Iraq are under contract. And they sign contracts, they're volunteers, and they're not released from those contracts when they come back. So they don't feel free like the draft ease of the Vietnam War did to go out, as soon as they came back, go out and begin demonstrating against this horrible war. So that's one difference, I think, right now.
Well, you know, it also, there was such a feeling of life and death. We had been in Vietnam. I had been in the intensive care ward. I had barely survived. I was in and out of morphine every 4 hours. People came in, and there was a pilot who died right next to me. There was a Viet Cong or North Vietnamese soldier directly across from me who died. People were just trying to live, and I was, you talk about American foreign policy, I was seeing it firsthand. I saw it firsthand when the bullet hit me, when the first Marine came up to get me from behind, was shot in the heart and died almost instantly, when the second Marine a few minutes later grabbed me, carried me back under heavy fire, and 22 years later I found out that he had been killed later that afternoon in an artillery attack. But what I'm trying to say is that there was such a passion, there was such an intensity to that time. If you were a part of that time, then you knew. I mean, we were working 7 days a week at that Vietnam Veterans Against the War office. We were going in and out of jail. We were on trial. I mean, this was life and death, literally. And we were up against this powerful government that was wrong, that was committing a terrible crime thousands of miles from our home, that was wounding and maiming, as it is doing today to this very day, wounding and maiming our young men and women, killing innocent civilians on the other side of the world who we have no business fighting against. There should be an outrage in this country as there was an outrage in the 60s. And I think when it affects you directly as it affected me, not only did I see it in the intensive care ward, I saw it in the Bronx Veterans Hospital, the overcrowded conditions, the rats on the ward. I saw some of the most severe disabilities. Do these senators or congressmen, does the president, do they have any idea what it means to really be wounded in a war, severely wounded? Does it mean to have a catheter, to be able to never be able to make children, to be able to, have to struggle with a severe disability a day and night, physically and emotionally, for decades? Do the American people understand when they make that crucial decision? You know, it's so easy. It's so easy for the public to say, you know, I support that war. I'm one of those 90% or 80% at the beginning of the present war. I support that war. But do they? Do these people who say, you know, I'm part of that? I'm supporting the president. I'm supporting our troops. Do they understand what it means, especially when young men and women are sent into a war as senseless, as immoral, and as legal as the war in Iraq is right now? It is shameful.
And I think that they've become also very media hip. As soon as something comes out negative about the war, about the VA hospitals, about the other day it came out that the barracks in Fort Bragg were falling apart, that they come out right away and say, no, it's not true, we're taking care of it, it's all right. And they're very, very media-wise these days, and almost make it so that people say, oh, well, government's taking care of it, it's not a problem. And I think
they have consistently neglected some of the most severe injuries, not only during the Vietnam War. We still have thousands of Vietnam veterans homeless, sleeping on the streets tonight. We have thousands of Vietnam veterans still suffering, still 40 years later. I'm 61 years old. I'll be 62 on the 4th of July. My age, still suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. Still not quite the same. They'll never be the same. This government consistently has neglected its wounded veterans. And those, it talks about, what a contradiction. You talk about support the troops. And the people who say support the troops, but will you support them? Will you support them? After they come home, will you support them when they're homeless, when they go to prison, when they're having constant nightmares, when they're wondering whether or not they're going to live to be 30 years old? We need to care about those. If we ask young men and women to serve and to sacrifice in these wars, we damn better take care of them when they come home.
Interesting.
I'm going to use the word again. It's absolutely shameful. It is. And, you know, they did not.
My question is,
a year before this war began, I was marching and I was demonstrating. A year before, I went to London in 2003, November. I led a march of several hundred thousand British citizens on Trafalgar Square. The night before, we had a reception at Mayor Ken Livingstone's office in London. The Mayor of London supported us. The Mayor of London marched with us. And the Mayor of London invited me to be the keynote speaker that night. No mayor in the United States ever asked me to give a keynote speech. I had to go across the Atlantic Ocean back to Great Britain for someone to finally ask me to speak in the mayor's office. It was an honor.
Well,
I mean, what we're doing to these young men. There should be an outcry in this country similar, if not more so, than that outcry we heard during the Vietnam War. This is unconscionable. This is unnecessary, and this is terribly wrong. This is an abuse of our young men and women. They are being victimized in this war. And the recruiters that are going into those high schools, especially low-income high schools, and they're going into those schools and they're preying on these young men and women and they're sending them off to these wars, this is absolutely shameful.
Ron, let me ask you, you know, obviously you're saying that the fact that our young men and women are going and coming back injured is one thing, but do you think that our government is fully honoring the plight of our injured soldiers once they return? Are we as Americans doing all that we can to care for the wounded? You've been in a lot of these hospitals. You go there. You talk to these young men and women.
No, we spend billions of dollars on this war, and they nitpick. And they would you agree with me, Frank? They cut back. I mean, how can we save money here? I mean, these young men and women deserve the very best care, and they don't get it. And they also deserve a government that understands that when you're wounded in a war and you come home, you don't fix it right away. Sometimes it takes years, sometimes it takes decades. You're going to be spending billions of dollars just caring for those who are coming back from this conflict. Would you agree?
I heard it takes almost 180 days for them to to get the proper service on this.
Yeah, the many who are suffering from PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, are waiting way too long. Have you heard that, Frank?
Yes, yes, I have. You know, it's funny, this whole thing that's coming out about Reverend Wright, in the film I made about Ron, Operation Last Patrol, in there, I looked it up the other day, because you can see it on Netflix instantly now. I say in there, I said, America's going to pay for this war. They're going to suffer from this. And this was the same thing he was saying. So, I mean, it's so similar. It's amazing that this country and the adults in this country, the gray-haired people like ourselves, didn't see it then and are repeating history over again. It just blows my mind and hurts me every day that these guys are going back for second and third tours. I can't imagine. They would have had
to see these young men and women. I was in the Long Beach Veterans Hospital about a year ago. I was in for about a month. I had a serious infection. But what happened during that time in the hospital, I was in bed for a long time. I was quite ill. But I heard that two doors down there were two Iraq vets who had just come back, and they were paralyzed Iraq vets. And actually, I'll tell you a story. When I was in the hospital, Tom Cruise was gracious enough to send some flowers. So he sent flowers to me, and they were a beautiful bouquet of flowers, actually several bouquets. I kitted around, and I said, you know, it looks like I've got a flower shop in my room here. And I thought to myself, what can I do with all these flowers? I just didn't feel comfortable having all of these beautiful flowers. So I sent two of the vases to both of the Iraq vets down the hall. And I took the rest of the flowers, and I made sure that they were given out to everybody that worked on the ward, all the patients and all the aides and all the nurses and every one of the doctors and even people on the night shift. Yeah, and even people on the night shift, and the only thing that I asked was that they tell the paralyzed Iraq vets, those recently wounded in the war, and tell the people who worked on the ward, and tell the doctors and the nurses that this was a gift from both myself and Tom Cruise, and that's all I said. There wasn't a particular political message. I didn't talk about the fact that I had strongly opposed the war. I just wanted to celebrate the people who were working with our young men who had come home. And I just wanted to celebrate those young men and wish them the very best on the difficult, arduous journey that lay ahead of them that I've been involved in for the past four decades, myself and so many others who were wounded in that war.
Yeah, these guys are
going to
be so...
Hello?
Frank, I wanted to ask you...
These guys are going to be so damaged. What?
Oh, go ahead, Frank. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
They're going to be so damaged by this war that we'll be paying for the next 30 or 40 years. I can just see it now.
Oh, at least. One of the things I just want to say,
we can do better than this. We're a better country than this. I think if the people of this country, the people of this country knew the truth, if they were willing to take the time to understand what was really going on here, they wouldn't stand for this for one day. They wouldn't allow their government to treat their young men and women in this fashion at all. I believe in the American people, and I believe that the American people, if they're able to recognize what's really going on, both in Iraq right now and in the VA hospitals and in Walter Reed, all over this country, then they will act and they will do what is needed to be done.
And not to mention what we've done to the Iraqi cities and their civilization. We've destroyed their society. It's awful.
It is unbelievable. You know,
we must not allow this behavior by our government. We have to make a clear distinction. We're not doing this. Our government is doing this in our name. They are behaving in a deeply immoral fashion. I think if Dr. King were alive today, and Dr. King said a year before he was assassinated at the Lorraine Motel on April 4th, 1968, on April 4th, 1967, at the Riverside Church in New York, his infamous Beyond Vietnam speech, where he came out and spoke passionately against the Vietnam War and caught a tremendous amount of flack for doing so. He said, a time comes when silence is betrayal. And I think that time has come in America for all of us right now. I think we can no longer be silent. We have to find the courage within ourselves, and we have to say what needs to be said. Our democracy is at stake. The lives of these young children, these young men and women, these brave and beautiful young men and women who are serving our country right now in a war they shouldn't they shouldn't be fighting, and we all need to speak out. We need to find the courage that Dr. King had and the courage that so many Americans have found within themselves in the past. And during the 60s, too, that was a time of great courage. The people who went to the streets were heroic, and they should be appreciated, not demonized as I believe Brokaw did in what was the name of that piece, book he did?
Something about the
60s,
or something, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
The baby boom was a boom, or something, a boom. But I think
Americans,
we need to honor those who resisted, honor those who protested, and honor those who had the courage as citizens to go to the streets peacefully and nonviolently and raise their voices in disgust against a policy that can only hurt our country. And that's what we need to do today. It's not over. We must continue to speak out.
Do you think Americans are doing enough? I know that our government certainly isn't doing enough to present the information here.
I think we need to do more. I think a great deal is happening. I mean, I think there's a lot of support. We had demonstrations, and it's not just, let's make it clear, I think Frank would agree with me, it's not just about demonstrations. They're important. We had nearly 500,000 people in Washington before the war began. On February 15, 2003, we had one of the biggest peace demonstrations both in the United States and around the world. We had, what was it, close to 30 million citizens, both American and citizens of the world, demonstrating peacefully against this war. The Pope, I believe it was John Paul at the time, the late John Paul, was opposed to the war. Nelson Mandela opposed the war. I mean, there's great potential out there. I think the American people need to wake up and recognize what's really going on. And I think we need to recognize this is probably one of the most crucial turning points in the history of our country. This is both a critical hour, a very painful period that we're going through, an agonizing period, but it is also a great opportunity. I think in all crises there is opportunity, and I found that in my own life. I was able to take a terrible wound and turn it into a triumph. I think we can do the same with our country.
Yeah, Frank, Operation Last Patrol is a documentary that resonates today in the form of Iraq. Can you tell our listeners what some of the similarities between the two, these two devastating wars are, in your opinion?
Yeah, well, first of all, they were both based on bogus material. You know, the Gulf of Tonkin incident, which turned out to be make-believe, and then on this war was weapons of mass destruction. And then they're also being backed and pushed along on the fact that some puppet government that we've set up is going to take over and do right, and their army is going to take over. The Arabs couldn't do it there, and the Iraqi army is not going to be able to do it here because their heart's not in it, and they're going to turn and run every time it gets tough. And I think the last thing about it is that the American people are not behind the war. So they're so similar on those three really big, important, basic points. Started on bogus information, some puppet government's going to take over with their army and make it all a democracy, and it's going to be fine. And in the end, the American people are suffering, and they don't want this war. So those three points, I think they're very similar. They're exactly alike.
And people, you know, for so long, I would agree with you, Frank, and people for so long have, you know, tried to tell us that there's no similarity between Iraq and Vietnam. There are so many. I see it's a mirror image in many ways of what we went through in Vietnam. We must learn from history. We have to learn from history. I think we will face ruination as a nation. Our democracy will continue to unravel unless we can learn. And we must listen to those who were victims of these policies in the past, because these are the people, these truth tellers are the people who will be our compass for the future.
Right.
They will lead the way to a new America and to a vibrant democracy, an authentic democracy for all the people and not just for a few people. What we're doing in Iraq is not only immoral, but
Ron, you know that the Vietnam War ended when we stopped supporting the war and the troops had to come home. And it's going to end the same way here, with a big tragedy of us having to rescue those people who have been backing there now.
And I'll tell you, Frank, I'm thinking back to Dr. King's speech at the Riverside Church in New York. It's a very famous speech, April 4th, 1967, the Beyond Vietnam. If you get a chance to, you can look it up on the internet. Breaking the Silence of the Night. Was one of the lines. If you just typed in Breaking the Silence of the Night, you'd get that speech. But Dr. King said in that very prophetic speech in 1967, a year to the day that he was to be assassinated in Memphis, he said that if we don't learn, I think it was one of his most important speeches, if we don't learn from Vietnam, from what's happening here, we're going to have Vietnam's for years to come. We're going to be marching for decades to come, and that's exactly what's happening. Dr. King predicted what's happening right now. We have got to wake up as a nation. We've got to recognize that we're repeating the same pattern all over again, that this government is repeating this pattern. We've got to challenge this government. We've got to stand up to this government. We must not be afraid or intimidated. Even with the great tragedy of 9/11, we've got to recognize that we are still citizens. We have our rights. We have a right to speak freely. We have a right to a redress of grievances. We can march. We can demonstrate. We can demand that this government redirect the priorities of our country and change this foreign policy, because if this foreign policy is not changed, we're going to move into an even deeper, a worse situation. Changes have got to be made, and they've got to be made soon. And I'm not sure if the presidential election is going to answer that. I think it's going to be a mass mobilization of people, grassroots, the American public, listening to radio stations like this radio station and recognizing that every single citizen is important. Every one of you out there that's listening to this right now, recognize the fact that you do have power. There is truth to that saying from the 60s, power to the people. There is power in the people, and there's much more power in the people than there is in the government in Washington, D.C. We are the United States of America. We are what makes it work. We are the ones who sacrifice, and we are the ones who come home with those wounds and have to live with those wounds for the rest of their lives. This is our country, and we've got to take it back.
We're going to be taking a break right now for just a minute. Before we do, I'd like to announce to all of our listeners, of course, you can always talk to Ron and Frank Kavastani, Ron Kovic, our guest tonight, and call us at 888-228-4494. For those of you that wish to donate to support our efforts, you can donate via the website. All donations are used to continue our work to present to you Truth in Media. And we'll be back in just a couple of moments. Again, our 1-800, our toll-free number is 888-228-4494. Call in and talk to our American icons that we have here this evening. We'll be back in just a moment.
Join us on the People Speak radio show every Tuesday and Wednesday from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern for an hour of live interview and audience interaction with guests from the realms of entertainment, education, activism, spirituality, politics, and literature. Get involved and make a difference for the better. That's the People Speak every Tuesday and Wednesday, 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern on BBS Radio Network.
Got questions? The library's got answers. And books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
This is Gore Vidal. Can you name the one country on earth where the government can steal elections, strip away basic rights, spy on civilians, launch wars based on lies, and where the people do not take over the nation's capital in protest? If you said the United States, you'd be right. So let's remedy that by calling our Congress members and asking them to support the impeachment of George Bush and Dick Cheney. This message is sponsored by AfterDowningStreet.org.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the People Speak Radio. Our guests tonight are Ron Kovic and Frank Tavastani of Born on the 4th of July and Operation Last Patrol Fame. We have a caller on the line, gentlemen. John Povinak from Los Angeles on line 4. John, do you have a question for our guests?
Yes. Why is there so little coverage of what's going on here compared to, like, say, in the Vietnam days when you read about it all the time? I have an anti-war art show at the 01 Gallery that is great, and it's getting no coverage. Last month I had a group show that got a ton of coverage, and it's both good. It's just they're not covering stuff now. They didn't even ask about Iraq in the in the debates, hardly. They're talking about, you know, the Reverend Wright in Chicago, when John McCain's got a reverend that's much farther out than Reverend Wright. Why don't they talk about that? You know, I don't get it. There's no coverage.
Go ahead. Thank you, John.
Well, I mean, like I say, for my part, I think it's so Orwellian, because society is confused. The pundits out there, the mainstream ones, are just talking corporate talk and talking against this war, and they're all making a big profit from it. And so it's allowed to, you know, very consciously go to the back pages.
We have a question from John from the Canadian Rockies. An email question. The question is, Ron, I just wanted to say that I think the world has too many war heroes and not enough anti-war heroes. You, sir, are an anti-war hero. Can you share your thoughts about conscientious objectors' roles in ending this war? Support the troops. Oops. Health and wealth of happiness, brother.
Oh, thank you very much. I support conscientious objectors, especially in this war, as much as what I did was in 1976 at the Democratic National Convention in New York, had the honor of seconding the nomination of war resister, draft resister Fritz Ifor for Vice President of the United States. It was a primetime audience. It's the largest audience I ever spoke in front of. A primetime TV audience, 40 million people, and I welcomed Fritz home. He had actually a Gold Star mother who had lost her son in Vietnam, Louise Rantham. She spoke first. I followed her. I welcomed Fritz and hugged him in front of the entire Democratic Convention, the Carter Convention in 1976. We were fighting at the time for unconditional amnesty for all those young men who had chosen to leave the country, go to Canada, go to Great Britain. In Fritz's case, he went to both Great Britain and Sweden. After applying for conscientious objector status, I believe it was in Kansas City. He applied. They turned him down. He did not want to fight in the war. He felt that the Vietnam War was immoral. He did not want to pull a trigger from of a rifle, did not want to kill another human being. He felt that this was a disastrous mistake. He was right. The government said to him, well, if you don't go, we're going to put you in jail. Many of our war resisters went to jail. Brave men like David Harris went to jail. But many of our young men during the Vietnam War who applied for conscientious objector status were turned down. And were forced to leave their country, leave their loved ones. I actually, in the beginning of the Iraq War, I participated in a conference with the use of a speakerphone. I was here in Redondo Beach, California, and I believe it was in Toronto, Canada, if I'm not mistaken. And I joined with American war resistors, not draft resistors, that was the Vietnam War, but Iraq, they were war resistors who had left the United States, gone to Canada, not as many as during the Vietnam War, but the numbers are growing. And I supported them, and I will continue to support war resistors. I will continue to support anyone listening to this program right now who is in uniform, anyone listening to this program right now who has his or her doubts about whether or not they want to go back to back to Iraq, whether or not they want to be deployed to Iraq in the first place, whether or not you want to go back to Iraq for a second, third, or fourth tour of duty. If you're having your doubts, realize that there are options. There are, you can apply for conscientious objector status. There are websites. There are people out there. There are resources that will help you, that will assist you, and they will be more than happy to support you in your effort to avoid having to go back into this conflict. If you feel that it is wrong, if you from what you have experienced, say for instance on your first tour of duty, you realize that this government has lied to you and sent you into a conflict you have no business being involved in, a conflict that is causing harm rather than liberating people, a conflict that is colonizing people and exploiting people rather than bringing democracy to a people. If you feel that way, then recognize that there are options, and you're not stuck, you're not trapped, you don't have to go back, and make an effort, and you will realize there are many people out there willing to help you and to keep you from going back to that war, and I will support you 100%. You can contact me through this radio network, and I will help you any way that I can to keep you from having to go back to that that war.
Well, thank you. I'm sure that means a lot to a lot of people out there. Phil Donahue just finished, we just interviewed Phil last week about his new documentary, Body of War. It really, I mean, obviously the two movies are so synonymous. Your stories are so closely tied. It must be unbelievably difficult for you to witness these young broken bodies coming home, such as Thomas Young in
Body of
War.
It is. It's painful. It's hard to describe. I think Oliver Stone said it well. He said it well a few months ago when we were together for supporting. Move On was doing a video vets piece on John Bruins, and we had a press conference in Santa Monica, and I remember him saying that it was like watching a nightmare all over, experiencing the nightmare all over again. That's what it's like.
I believe he actually called it a bit of a time warp. He said it was echoes of violence.
Many things. A deja vu all over again. We know that song.
Yeah.
Who did that song? A wonderful musician did a song called Deja Vu All Over Again. It's a great song, too. Did you ever hear that song, Frank?
Yeah, I think I did. I can't remember who it was by, though. But the thing
is Clearwater Revival. That was John Fogerty, a brilliant song. John Fogerty sang a brilliant song. I believe he wrote it as well, called Deja Vu All Over Again. If you get a chance to hear it, it's great. But
wasn't Crosby, Stills, and Nash, I think, that did that song. Anyway, in that movie, Bobby Muller and Young get together, and it's an amazing scene.
Yeah, it really is powerful. You know what I remember in that interaction between Bobby Muller, who is one of our most courageous Vietnam veterans and founded Paralyzed like myself. And actually, Bobby and I were both in the Bronx Veterans Hospital together about the same time. And it was Bob Muller who later founded the Vietnam Veterans of America, Robert Muller, who invited me to speak for the very first time at Levittown Memorial High School on Long Island. And I was very hesitant, and it's just a story. Bobby called me all week, and I was thinking, I had never spoken in public before, and this was very, very early 70s, 71 I think it was, and I'd just gotten out of the Bronx Veterans Hospital, and I was just, I had just begun going to Hofstra University in my wheelchair, and Bobby was calling me, and we had met in the hospital, and he was calling me, and actually, he had Bobby had met with Allard Lowenstein, the late Allard Lowenstein, who began the Dump Johnson movement during the Vietnam War. But to make a long story short, Bobby tried to convince me to speak, and I was very hesitant. I remember thinking, what will my mother and father say? What will the veterans at the university say? What will I become part of a file? You know, I was worried. I remember I had never spoken, and I was afraid to speak. And I remember finally having a sleepless night, not being able to sleep at all, and I had to make a final decision. It was the very morning that I was supposed to join him at the high school, and he called me one last time. He had been trying to convince me all week, and I finally said, yes, I'll come down, and I went down. And this is an interesting story, Frank, and I went down, and I was a bit nervous, and I drove my hand-controlled car down to the high school. It was not far from the university and the apartment I was living in at the time by myself. This was 1971, and I had just gotten out of the hospital, and I went into the high school, and they carried me up the steps to join, and Bobby was already on the stage. And Bobby, I remember Bobby spoke, and then I went out to speak, and I began to talk about the hospitals and the overcrowded conditions. And right in the middle of my speech, my very first speech, there was a bomb threat, and they cleared the auditorium, and all the students had to leave the auditorium. There was a bomb threat. It never happened again, and I was to speak for decades following that very first speech, but my first speech was interrupted by a bomb threat, and I was apprehensive. I was apprehensive to begin with to give this speech. As many of us, you know, we're afraid to speak, and I go back to King again, and Dr. King talks in that Beyond Vietnam speech in 1967 about how difficult it is, especially during a time of war, to oppose your own government, to speak. But King talks about the fact that he had to speak. His conscience cried out for him to speak. I mean, he knew something was wrong. He could feel it. And he understood. I understand those words, a time comes when silence is betrayal. I mean, he understood, and I did. That morning, I made that decision, and it changed my life. It changed my life, that decision, to go down to that high school that day to speak to those kids, to show them the war, to show them what American foreign policy back then was really all about. And right in the middle of it, someone tried to silence me. Someone tried to shut me up. Someone tried to frighten me, but it didn't frighten me. We went outside, and we went straight. We organized everyone. It was a bit chaotic at first, but we organized everyone. They all stayed with us, and we said, let's go over to the football grandstands, which we did. We walked over to the football field. Everybody, all the students, there were close to 200 students. They sat in the grandstands, and Bobby and I continued my speech. I finished it, and I spoke more passionately than ever, and I haven't stopped speaking since.
Right, and Ron, this is a good time to tell the bestman and everybody that you're going to be speaking at Kent State.
By email today, what I'm going to be doing is I'm going to be speaking. They're going to be showing Born on the 4th of July on the night of the 3rd of May at Kent State. And what they're going to be doing is, this is just before their annual candlelight march, candlelight vigil. They're going to walk through campus as they have every May 3rd before the 4th. They will walk through campus with candles. Many of the people leading the march will be victims of that fateful day,
well,
on May 4th, 1970, when four students were killed in Ohio.
Which brings me to a question,
but I just
Frank,
wanted to say what I'm going to be doing is I'm going to be speaking over a speakerphone to the students, and hopefully on the 4th on the Commons. I've spoken there many times, was arrested there in the late 70s, but I will be speaking on a speakerphone, and hopefully I will be able to speak on the 4th of May with William Kunstler's daughters, and Scott Ritter will be the main speaker. The UN weapons inspector is going to be speaking that day, and I hope to be speaking with them via speakerphone this year.
That sounds wonderful. I wish you both success with that. I'd like to ask you, Frank, do you have any new projects on the horizon that we need to be looking for?
No, but the thing that's happening now with the media, and it's so wonderful, especially for people that are into film and making films, is they can go online, and at Netflix, they can click on and instantly play my documentary, and then switch over and instantly play Born on the 4th of July, and see how the two films were used to help each other and support each other, and how the images were transferred one from the other, how documentaries, you know, help support, feature filmmaking. So that's one thing that people can do now, and they can be home. They don't have to go to L.A. or New York. They can actually learn from any spot in the world and see it all on the Internet. So that's one thing that's getting out there. And thousands of people around the world are watching it now. So it is having an even more so impact with this new media of the Internet. So that's exciting.
Frank, how do you? What would you suggest to young filmmakers that are trying to get the truth? You know, we have so many documentaries about this war in Iraq, and coming with from such a long history of noble efforts here. What would you recommend to people? I mean, as you heard, one of our callers it was concerned that the word is just not getting out. How do we really get the word out in film and take advantage of the Internet for these purposes?
Well, I've always said one thing about filmmaking. It only takes one person to really get a film made. I mean, and that person has to drive to the end to make it, get it made. I mean, I had no money, and I just kept going and borrowing editing rooms from people and borrowing film and equipment. And so the thing is that if you have something that you're passionate about, just go for it. Get a little camera, begin doing it. And you'd be surprised. I had people when I was down in Miami with Ron come out of the NBC building and on the sneak give me sound tapes because I had run out. And they said, don't tell anyone, we're giving you this. But like the other side was helping me out. So I mean,
yeah, I would agree. What Frank did was amazing, and I would agree that you must never give up. That's the most important thing. You must persist and never give up and believe that you can make a difference. Look what happened in South Africa. Mandela in prison, 28 years, becomes the president of his country. Look what happened in Eastern Europe. Václav Havel, who was a prisoner, becomes the president of his country, sweeping changes, things that were unimaginable. Look what happened in the Philippines. The wife of Benigno Aquino, Corazon Aquino, a simple housewife, becomes the leader of her country. You never know unless you try. And I feel as if my life has been a blessing in disguise. I've been given the opportunity. When I was wounded, I wondered if I would ever have a life. And I've been given the opportunity to reach millions of people with a message of peace and nonviolence, and a message that says we need to change this country. We're a better country than this. We can be a more vibrant democracy. We don't need to be wiretapped. We don't need to be felt as if we're living in a police state. This is a free country, and we all want to live freely, and we all want a different policy that does not create more Ron Kovics and Thomas Youngs, but less. And creates more schools, more hospitals, more parks, and more beautiful things instead of the terrible tragedies this government is giving us to this day.
Do you think we'll be attacking Iran? Yes, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Frank.
The other thing is that a great artist once said to me that the best films are anthropology. So these students must know that they may make something now which seems small, but when it's looked at 20, 30, 40, 50 years from now, it may be the only truth that's getting out from that past time. So it's very important to make the effort and to record it.
It's better to light one candle than curse the darkness. That's a great saying.
Yeah, we've only got a couple of minutes, and I'd like to ask you briefly about two things. Do you think we'll be attacking Iran in 1 minute? And who are you supporting, each of you, in this election?
Well, I was a strong Hillary supporter, but Obama's impressing me every day, so it's hard. That one's a tough one, and I'd rather hold back on that. But the thing is that it frightens me to death to think that we possibly could be mad enough and insane enough, like Hitler, and invade Iran as he did Poland and Western and Eastern Europe. I mean, have we really gone completely insane with attacking another Mid-Eastern country? It's nuts. I just can't even talk about it. It's so crazy an idea.
Well, I think Frank has spoken for me eloquently, and I think it would be a great mistake to attack Iran, it would be a tragedy, and I think that we have to do everything that we can to make sure that that doesn't happen. Who am I supporting? I want to say I support the American people, and I hope they wake up. I hope they recognize that the difference, the change that is needed in this country, the sweeping changes, nonviolent, peaceful, but sweeping changes that are needed in this country are going to happen the same way they happened in South Africa and in Eastern Europe and around the world by millions of people demonstrating peacefully and nonviolently in cities all over our country. The people of this country have got to make the change. They cannot be so dependent on one particular leader. We have watched time and time again leaders come into power, even sympathetic leaders who have promised so much and given the people so little. The people must make the changes, and the people are the real power in this country, and we need to get busy, and we need to change this country and begin to believe recognize how powerful you are, because all of us are much more powerful than we realize, and we all can make a difference if we only are willing to step over that line and try and find the courage within ourselves to make a difference in our lives.
And you know the same thing, I'm not a conspiratorial kind of person, but the scary thing is that this government will cause the war in Iran to assuage and change the election, and that is very, very scary, but it's entirely possible because we see things like that happen every day now.
Well, I absolutely agree with you. Gentlemen, it has been a great honor and a pleasure having you. It just seems like we never have enough time to talk with and ask you all of the questions that we want to ask you. Remember, listeners, we here at the People Speak Radio took the four-letter word lies out of media and put truth in their place. We'll see you tomorrow night with our guest, Tom Perriello. He's the Democratic 5th Congressional Congressman of the District of Virginia, with my host, David Swanson. On May 6th, next Tuesday night, I will be interviewing Dan Millman. Dan is the author of The Peaceful Warrior's Way, and his new book is just astounding. I took it with me to Florida with a group of girls, and you guys got to hear some of the stuff that happened then. We're looking forward to seeing you all next week. Thank you, gentlemen, for being with us on the People Speak
Radio. Thank you. You're the best.
Thank you.
You guys are great. Good luck in all of your endeavors and in all of your work. We really, really appreciate it. Absolutely.
Okay.
Thank you very much. And that's it, folks, for tonight. We'll see you tomorrow
Brian,
night.
Okay, Brian, I'll see you. I'll call you
Take
soon.
Care, Brian.
Bye.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the sea wall by the relief confess, I saw my people and they stood there hungry and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is yours. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.
Hello, this is Wesley Snipes, and when I want to get tuned in, tuned up, and not tuned out, I listen to Dr. Fred Bell, Health and Sciences Show on BBSRadio.com. Mary had a little lamb, Mary had a little lamb, and went off to the Pleiades. Woo!
Where would $5,000 per week take you? Discover the exact details of a simple and proven system that quickly puts $5,000 to $10,000 in many students' pockets every week. What's most amazing is that there are almost no computer skills required, and you can start pulling in cash automatically within just a few hours. We are absolutely convinced that our proven system will create massive wealth for virtually anyone, and we'll prove it. Go to bbscashflow.com now and get all the details. That's bbscashflow.com.